Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Today's episode marks a special milestone for our show. This is our 250th podcast and our 5th year anniversary. You heard correct. We've been at this for 5 years, and in addition to today's discussion, you can find an additional 249 interesting interviews on a wide range of topics in our internet archives. And thanks to the good folks at Baylor's Institute for Studies of Religion, all of this comes to you at no charge, our educational gift to you. The only thing we ask in return is that you help us spread the word. Please tell a friend, colleague, family member, or a teacher who might find these podcasts helpful in the classroom. And don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes, like us on Facebook, and or follow us on Twitter. We always appreciate the company. So for our 250th show, my initial predilection was to go big. Perhaps get Pope Francis, Billy Graham, or the Dalai Lama in for an interview. But alas, all of those folks were busy and did not return my calls. By the way, if any of you happen to know the Pope, let him know that I would be interested in talking with him. But not to worry, because one of the guiding principles of this podcast series is to bring the research, knowledge, and wisdom of folks who otherwise would not have a big stage, yet who have something interesting and important to say, to the attention of a broader audience. In the past, I've had a number of professors and graduate students who are not often featured in the popular media, and I've also showcased everyday practitioners, such as cowboy pastors and prison ministers, who also have a great deal to share. But today is a first on the show, as we feature a freshly minted high school graduate from the Bear Creek School in Redmond, Washington, who did a senior project on the faith of President Ronald Reagan. That student, Phoenix Muma, is here with me in person at the Bear Creek School, which graciously gave us permission to tape the interview on their grounds. Phoenix's project caught my attention when several of my friends told me that I had to see this young man, what he had done, and how well-spoken he was for a high school senior. Moreover, as we shall see, Phoenix's project was not just of academic interest, something that he needed to whip up so he could meet a graduation requirement. But rather, it was based on something very personal, some very personal familial connections. His grandfather, Don Mumau, was Ronald Reagan's pastor for many, many years. And Phoenix had access to some personal correspondence that sheds light onto the president's religious outlook and how it affected his approach to governing. Letters which, heretofore, have not been made public. So this is certainly a treat, not only to learn about this aspect of Reagan's life that has not been looked at very much, but because we have such a fantastic young scholar to tell us all about what he found. Phoenix, thanks for being on the 250th episode of Research on Religion.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, before we dig into the findings of your project on the faith of Ronald Reagan and how it affected his governing style, I want to get an understanding of this so-called senior project that you did. When I went to school, we didn't have senior projects. They just wanted us to graduate without causing any major damage to the school building. If you did that, congratulations, you can move on. So tell us, what is the nature of this so-called senior project?
It's rather open-ended. When they give it to us as a rubric and as a packet in February, we kind of just are told to go out and find something that we're passionate about. If you don't mind, I have the purpose from the project packet.
Please read that to us.
The purpose of Bear Creek's Senior Capstone Project is to provide each senior with the opportunity to develop and pursue a challenging, meaningful, and self-directed project in an area of personal interest during the last 3 weeks of the spring semester. So successful senior projects, they share a number of important attributes. They demonstrate a depth of investment and insight, exhibit a significant level of personal challenge, and advance a student's ability to articulate how their worldview has been explored, challenged, or changed by the project experience. So it's largely up to us to kind of figure out something that we can do for 3 weeks, that we have 3 weeks worth of interest in, and then that we can go out and actually spend 6 hours a day for that time working on whatever this is.
So you're not going to class during this period of time.
No.
The last 3 weeks of school, you are basically working on this project.
Yeah, and so they have to hold us accountable to be in school by standards that is set by the school. So we're still working a full six-hour day. We're still having to set time schedules, meet requirements, meet goals that we've set for ourselves.
Well, that's pretty cool because I know the last 3 weeks of when I was in high school, I pretty much checked out anyways, but wasn't doing a senior project. So at least they have you doing something here for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And it's pretty cool. The purpose is to really have you engage in something that you've never done before. Let me ask you this. We're going to talk about your project here in a minute, but what are some of the other projects that students did?
One of them just sewed different skirts, shirts, and dresses and some things that they were interested in. And for Worldview, we kind of found out that she had grown some respect for different artistry that comes with sewing different kind of fabrics and sewing different shirts and things. Another student spent some time at Habitat for Humanity working in day-to-day volunteer operations, and she grew some respect for mundane work that people do and kind of developed her her abilities in those kinds of regards. Another student spent some time at an investment firm working what he found out was 8:30 to 6 rather than 9 to 5. And his project was incredible because he learned a lot through failure in that. I mean, that was his first opportunity really diving into a huge project. And so he got to spend a lot of time working actually with his boss, and he got to have a lot of one-on-one conversations that he wasn't really expecting.
And learning from failure, I have to admit, is a great lesson. A lot of times don't take that as a meaningful lesson. We just say a failure is a failure, but learning from failure is always very important. So that sounds like a fun project. What else you got there?
There were some people who worked with furniture and made different kind of woodworking creations, and there were some different martial arts that were being studied throughout those weeks. So it was a very diverse category. Honestly, like you said, there are a lot of students who just tend to kind of fade into the background in the last 3 weeks. So I think this is a great way to kind of bring out some passion during that time and really kind of set the stage for yourself so that you can have fun during your last 3 weeks while still learning a lot about yourself and a field that you're interested in.
Yeah, I can imagine this gives people a big sense of accomplishment too, that you do a project that has a 3 week boundary and you finish it and you can say, hey, look what I did. And then you showcase this too, as this is how you came to my attention. Everybody says they present these high school seniors, they're presenting their projects, and you got to see this Phoenix guy. He's like really good, and this is pretty interesting. Let me ask you about your project.
Yeah.
You mentioned that they give you this packet about what to do on the project early in the school year, or February of the year that you're graduating. But did you have an idea of what you wanted to do? Because you, as a junior, you see all the seniors doing this.
Yeah.
You know this is coming down the railroad tracks.
Oh, yeah.
So did you have an idea of that's what you wanted to do? Did you have different ideas? When did you formulate this idea?
You know, we start asking each other sarcastically around sophomore year what we're thinking about doing for our senior project. And everyone has these grand ideas. Someone wanted to learn how to play a cello piece, but obviously that's pretty far out there and a lot more than 3 weeks can handle. So we start to kind of refine and stuff when we actually get the project senior year. And I had some ideas that were kind of percolating. But then I found these letters at Thanksgiving. So that was before we got the actual packet in February, but it was so I found those letters in Thanksgiving, and then it took a couple of weeks later for someone to say, "Hey, you should make a senior project out of that." And I thought, well, that's great because it's bringing in family connections. It's setting something. Because when I found them, I thought, oh, I should scan these in because my family would love to read these. We can't just kind of pass them around. We live too far apart to really have that be an efficient way to get them around to everyone. So having them online was great, but I knew I wasn't really going to have time. So this, first of all, was a great way to make myself sit down and kind of scan all of these in for the benefit of my family. But then it also just kind of came up that there was a lot more there that could be uncovered. Covered.
I was planning on asking this a little bit later, but since you brought it up, you talked about I found these letters around Thanksgiving. What was that? Your mom told you to go out and get the big platter for the turkey, and then all of a sudden, oh, look, there's a bunch of letters that are falling out of the cabinets here. How'd you find a bunch of letters?
Well, my grandparents lived in their last house for, I think they were coming on 40 or 50 years. Mm. And they just moved out a little bit ago, so they were doing a bunch of cleaning. And so I can't actually take credit. My aunt found them as she was kind of cleaning out some of the garage, and she found – it was either on a shelf or in a box or something, but it was just a bunch of folders that were all titled Reagan and something having to do with Reagan. And so we brought them out, and some of us who were more interested had a look at them and just kind of scrolled through, if you will, and looked at all of what was there. And so I was just so impressed by a lot of the, you know, like the governorship head or the cardstock, and then the White House, how it was just there and printed and in front of me and so tangible. So
that must have been a really cool feeling. I people don't really understand this about research. They tend to think about laboratories and a very aseptic type of environment where everything is controlled and isolated, and scientists are very particular about keeping their cool and things like this. But oftentimes we do get affected by our research. And so all of a sudden you stumble upon this pile of folders your aunt finds and says, oh, look, we found some things from the White House. And you pick these up for the first time. Was it kind of cool just all of a sudden holding something that Ronald Reagan had handwritten and it says the White House on it?
Yeah, I mean, there's kind of a thought that I have, and I'm sure I'll come back to this because it was a theme throughout my project, but there's a thought that I have when I think, oh, someone had a relationship with a president, and I think of that relationship as one direction, where there's a lot of information and kind of recommendations going at the president, but not a whole lot coming back. So to have all of these communications that Ronald Reagan was sending back to my grandfather, and some of which were saying, I know you're busy, but here's some kind of articles and stuff, that was just so cool to see that it actually was a mutual relationship and that it had gone back and forth and that there was interest and that there was something that my grandfather could give that Reagan didn't think he had. And so there was a lot, and so obviously I'd heard that he was his pastor, that my grandfather was the pastor for Ronald Reagan in the past, but I never really had anything to say, this is what that relationship looked like. And so that kind of changes my concept of their relationship, their conversations, their communication, whatever happened between them, because now it's real. Now I'm actually able to see, wow, there was communication back and forth. It was mutual. There was something there that was more than just, oh, pastor, congregation.
And just holding a piece of history, too. And a piece of history that nobody else had. Yeah. Nobody else knew existed. They were in some garage in California somewhere, right?
Well, wow. It worked out well for me.
Yeah. No, very, very fascinating. So you mentioned your grandfather here, and these folders were sitting in your grandfather's garage. Tell us a little bit about your grandfather. He was Reagan's pastor and has these letters. So who's Grandpa Mumau, and how'd this guy get to be the pastor for a president?
Well, he was born in Santa Ana in 1931, I believe was his birth year. His father was a math teacher, so I mean, he did grow up. He went to UCLA for college. He was an offensive center and linebacker in the early 1950s. And after he left, he was put into the UCLA Hall of Fame, and he was given the Don D. Mumau Award. Well, he had an award named after him, the Don D. Mumau Award for Best Defensive Player against USC.
Yeah, go Bruins. And down with USC. I should note that I am a UCLA alumnus, so UCLA, fight, fight, fight.
So then how did he get from the gridiron to the pulpit? How did he get from football to preaching at Bel Air Presbyterian Church? Well, he was drafted. He was a first-round pick to the California Rams back when they were the California Rams. And he didn't want to play on Sundays, and the NFL obviously plays on Sundays. So he said at the time, and he reaffirmed when I interviewed him, that wasn't a statement. He wasn't trying to say the NFL shouldn't play on Sundays. He wasn't trying to change football. He just had a conviction that he wanted to hold that day as holy. He wanted to hold it as Sabbath. He had found God during college, and he had really kind of just discovered that that was something he wanted to hold central to his life. So then he went up and played Canadian football for a little while, and after a year or two or of that, he came back down to Princeton Seminary. And at some point during this time, he had met Billy Graham, because at this point he was kind of a figure in the public eye, and so Billy Graham wanted to take him on a sort of world tour to talk to different audiences about Billy Graham's mission, about and just give his personal testimony. And so he ended up sharing his personal testimony with a large portion of the globe. And so he returned home eventually, went to Princeton Seminary, and he was still playing some Canadian football on the side for some money. He would fly up on weekends and play some football and then just return back and try and do homework, and he has no idea how he managed to get everything in. So then he managed to get into Bel Air as the previous minister was moving to a Presbyterian church in D.C., and so he was flipping coasts, and so was my grandfather coming back to California, and so he ended up at Bel Air. And obviously that's a central location to Hollywood and Beverly Hills, so he had a large number of wealthy celebrity types that were coming to the church, and so that's when he first met Ronald Reagan.
And what period was this? Was 1950s, early 60s? What are we talking about here that he started at Bel Air Presbyterian?
That's going to be early 60s.
Okay.
Because most of the 50s, he graduated from UCLA, I believe, in 53 or 54. And then so he would have spent the rest of the 50s in Princeton and on that world tour. And then so, yeah, the 60s would have been when he ended up at Bel Air.
Okay, so early 60s. And how long was he pastor at Bel Air Presbyterian for?
He was there, I believe, through 92.
Okay, so a pretty long period of time, especially for a pastor staying at one place. And as you mentioned, Bel Air, for those of you who are not familiar with the area, that is the really kind of a ritzy place in California. It sits above the hills of Hollywood and Westwood right there by UCLA. And how does he end up meeting Reagan in the first place? So was Reagan attending this church in the 60s? What's going on?
Yeah, so he was attending the church in the 60s. So when they first met, it was more of an actor kind of and I don't want to say one in a crowd, because it wasn't just a whole bunch of actors, celebrities that were going to this church. So yeah, it was when they met, it was kind of just a congregation pastor piece. It wasn't until he started to become more of a political figure, and as far as I can tell, not until my grandfather was invited to give the inaugural prayer at his governor inauguration, that relationship started to change a little bit. And that wasn't because my grandpa was like, oh, now I can change culture. Oh, now I have a tie-in to the governorship. It was just like there's a lot more stress going on in the life of this person, and he has a lot more on his shoes. And so there would be a couple of times where he could get a personal call, and my grandpa would go and visit Reagan at his house and just pray with him and just be a vent for him. So,
and this is really interesting, because the California State House is up there in Sacramento, which is quite a ways away from Los Angeles. And so to stay in contact with the former pastor that you had, or I guess the current pastor, is pretty amazing. There must have been a relationship there, because you could see, you know, people move towns and they say, well, you know, I used to be going to Bel Air Presbyterian, but now I'm up in Sacramento, so I'll find Sacramento First Presbyterian Church. And you say your goodbyes and you never meet again. But there was this ongoing relationship there. So there must have been a very strong personal attachment.
Yeah. The one story that my grandpa tells in this regard is the first time that Reagan was given the chance to pardon someone when they were going to be given the death penalty. And Reagan was a strong proponent of a strong supporter of the death penalty. But when you have that opportunity to save or take someone's life, it's a heavier issue to deal with. And so my grandfather went over to just kind of be a source for him to vent, and a source for him to just kind of get out his feelings. And he ended up, of course, not sparing the man's life and sticking true to what he believed was right for justice, what was morally correct in that situation. But my grandfather was proud with how he dealt with the issue, how he struggled with it internally.
And it's interesting to see, too. We see on the news, somebody's could possibly pardon a death penalty inmate, but they didn't. And that's all we see in the news, but we don't see that struggle behind there. It's got to be a tough decision.
Oh, it is. Yeah.
And to see that Ronald Reagan was actually consulting with his pastor from Bel Air, saying, hey, you know, I'm really having some struggles with this. So how did the relationship continue? Reagan was in the State House for a while, or the governor's mansion, I should say, and then he was out of office for a while. He tried running for office in the 1968, I believe, for the presidency. Didn't go very well. And then he's out of office. Did what's going on here? Did he move back down to Bel Air? Was there a relationship that still was on? What's happening?
Yeah. So at that point, he was back down at Bel Air. He had moved back in, I believe he moved back into his old house. Obviously, he had the ranch and everything that was still fully thriving and everything. So during that period, yeah, he was back down at Bel Air. There was some kind of a back and forth. But there's honestly not a lot of evidence, and it could just be that the letters that were back and forth weren't in the files, since they weren't these presidential letterheads and everything. But yeah, so obviously there was a relationship that continued, because then when he was elected to the presidency in the 80s, then my grandfather was asked back again to give that inaugural prayer, and he was criticized for monopolizing that the inauguration for the first presidential term. So there was a lot going on during that period, and I think it's not documented from what I have, just because they were probably close, so there wasn't as many letters going back and forth, because they got to talk on a Sunday, or Reagan got to come in on a weekday and just chat with him if he had any concerns, and just generally there wasn't as much pressure on Reagan, so I don't think there was as much to correspond about during that time.
Yeah, you have that personal correspondence if you're just in the area, so you call up somebody on the phone or stop by their house, or after church on a Sunday, you sit down and talk about different things. But when you're far away, Sacramento or then Washington, D.C., then you start writing letters. And one thing that I found out, and I was recently at the Reagan Ranch Center down in Santa Barbara, California, we were able to see some of his personal correspondence with a pen pal friend he had throughout the entire presidency, a member of his fan club. It's quite amazing how prolific of a writer he was. You would think, well, this is somebody who's really busy. They're running the state of California. They're doing stuff in Hollywood. They're doing stuff in Washington, D.C., running the United States. Got to be pretty busy. But, you know, wow, it was pretty amazing to see that he took a lot of time to write a lot of personal correspondence and not have somebody else do it. Write this in his own handwriting.
Yeah, he spent a lot of time. That was a large part I found out of what he was doing while he was at the ranch, is that he would just sit down and respond to a lot of the letters that he got while he was in office, and just didn't have time to do while he was at the White House. And then he would get out on the ranch and reconnect and kind of de-stress and just sit and write a lot of these letters. Yeah.
Yeah, I have to ask, did your grandfather get a chance to go up to the ranch and hang out with him? And also your father. Your father is obviously hanging around with Dad. Dad says to your dad, so Grandpa says to your father, hey, this is Ronald Reagan. He was the governor of California. No, he's the president now. And, you know, that's got to be kind of cool.
Yeah. There was one instance mentioned in one of the letters where I think it was either at a prayer breakfast or something local where, yeah, my dad and I think my grandma went and met him. And we're just kind of there and just experiencing whatever this convention was. And then there was another time that my dad just mentioned this morning when I was asking him about it. And it was Reagan hosted a country music concert at the ranch for, and I don't know these people, but maybe you will, is Mark O'Connor, Beverly Stills, and Merle Haggard.
Oh, I know Beverly Stills and Merle Haggard. I don't know the first one, but yeah.
So, and he said it was just a concert that they all, a bunch of kids and adults, got onto a bus at a local school, and they were all taken up to the ranch. And my dad said that Reagan was sitting right in front of him, and that there was a picture taken at the time that he couldn't find. Mm. But so, yeah, I mean, he was close. He was in proximity when the first inauguration came around. All of my dad's immediate family went up, or went over across, I guess, to D.C. for the inauguration, and they were all there. He, when we went back to D.C. a couple of years ago, he was getting impatient a couple of times, and my mom and I kept joking that he was missing his first family pass that would just get him to the front of every line, no, just reservations wherever he went. So
yeah, what's the deal? Back in the 80s, I could go wherever I wanted.
Exactly.
Now, yeah.
So there was some kind of a privilege like that, but it was mostly just kind of in special occasions. There wasn't really a strong relationship between my father and Reagan, but he did meet him on a number of occasions. So
let me talk about these letters that you did find. And as I just mentioned, Reagan was a prolific writer of letters to different people. Overall, what was the impression that you got from reading the letters? Were they very formal? Were they very casual? What were some of the things that were being talked about in some of these letters?
I would say both formal and casual. Each letter followed a pretty general form that was repeated over and over again. They were friendly at the beginning. They had a greeting, and then they took care of whatever business in the middle, and then they had a friendly close goodbye. Mm-hmm. And so I'd like to read one letter in particular that I think kind of summarizes
this. That would be great. So read us one of these letters here.
It says, "I don't mean to belabor you, but these two articles are very definitely confirmed by our own intelligence and on-the-spot observations. There is no question but that the Sandinistas have a very sophisticated disinformation network, which seems to have taken over much of our news media. You'll recall that I told you of meeting the clergyman whose ears had been cut off. His story is in the enclosed clipping. I also met with one whose face was a gargoyle mask, the result of burns as part of his torture. Well, enough already. Nancy sends her love." So there's usually this kind of beginning that's, "Hello, Don, just maybe a how are you doing? I hope your family is well." Then they kind of take care of some of this information, and this was one of the more informative letters that was talking a little bit more, because if you'll recall, there was a large period of time where the Presbyterian Church in America was not seeing much of the abuse that was going on with the Sandinista regime, and the Reagan administration was maintaining a lot of their, "No, they're communists, no, they're repressing their people," and all of this. So there were a number of correspondences back and forth about the Sandinistas that were just saying, "Are they oppressing? Are they not?" And Reagan kept affirming, "We have intelligence that you're not, you're missing, you're falling prey to their misinformation campaigns." So this I thought was a great example, because it deals with a lot of great issues in the middle, and then ends with just "Nancy sends her love." And so there's a personal touch there at the end, and of course he hand signs every letter. And I'm sure you would be able to affirm whether he does that with each letter that he sent. But most of them were typed out, and then he would just write a little note sometimes at the end. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, no, I've seen these, and you can see these at the Simi Valley Reagan Library, too, that he does. Some of them are very personal and handwritten, but as you mentioned here, you know, he's president now, and you got all these things going on, and so you're going to type that up because it's a bit more formal. But it's kind of revealing that you would send your pastor information about, "Oh, we're dealing with the Sandinista regime here, and these are some of the abuses going on." And I can see why. The Presbyterian Church was giving a lot of pushback. Your father was a Presbyterian minister, so saying, "Hey, listen, you guys got to, you know, see a little bit of things that I'm seeing here."
And they had created the Presbyterian Task Force to deal with some of these issues, because there were a lot of Presbyterians that were being oppressed and were being kind of there was some stuff going on in the Sandinistas with the Presbyterians as a church themselves. And so there was a task force specifically created for Central America for dealing with this with these issues. And my grandfather kind of organized that, and he made sure that they were able to meet before the president and kind of present their side of the issue. And Reagan heard them, and Reagan sent a letter thanking my grandfather for organizing it and making sure that he, you know, heard from his people. But my grandfather joked, and he maintains now, that he doesn't think anything that he ever said to Reagan ever convinced him to change his mind. That there was, he took it in and he truly listened to it, and it perhaps kind of shaped how he acted, but it never changed his mind.
And that gets to the thesis of your senior project, and I want to dive into this a little bit because you found some very interesting things here, and it's a rather sophisticated project for a senior in high school and only doing this over a couple of weeks. I'm sure you were thinking about it in broader terms over several months since you found the letters, but to do what you did in 3 weeks is pretty amazing. If you could, walk us through that whole three-week process. One of the things that you provided me was a diary that documented what you did on a day-to-day basis. So walk us through what you had to do for the project and how you did it.
So the first week was mostly spent organizing the communications and scanning them in online so that I could have a searchable database so that I didn't have to just flip through them to kind of find something that I wanted to look at. So I could search for keywords or kind of hot
And how many letters were there? I should ask that.
I never counted, and that's kind of embarrassing to admit.
But there's a lot of scanning there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. I was sitting there watching Seinfeld the whole time. So.
And a lot of people do that during research, I have to admit, you know, that they research is this deep thought stuff, but a lot of it is scanning in documents, putting them in chronological order. And, I usually have the headphones on listening to Lynyrd Skynyrd or something, but yeah.
So the first day was I just organized them chronologically year by year. And then I went through and scanned all of them, and that whole process took about 2 days. Third day, I was reading through everything. So I actually read all of the letters to kind of start to pull out some issues that I knew I would want to look at while in California. And then I also read a lot, because in these folders were not just letters, but also the corresponding documents, like was mentioned in that selection that I read, and other articles from the time that just kind of talked about my grandpa and his relationship to the president and had different quotes that were going on. So I read through a lot of that on the third and fourth day. And then on the fifth day, I took a plane flight down to California, and I went that first day and got a research card in Simi Valley at the Reagan Library.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
This is not just your typical tourist going through and looking at the statues and a few signed artifacts in the library part, but you get that research pass to go behind the scenes, huh?
Yeah. So that was the first Friday.
Oh, wait, I gotta ask you about that research pass, because you're science like, I got a research pass. you had to have been walking around and holding that thing going, I got a research pass. Was that cool?
Well, you get a badge too, and they're at home. I have three of them for each of the days I researched, and they're all sitting on my little keyboard, I guess, holder, if you will.
Yeah.
So they're all there. Oh, yeah. It was,
That's cool.
To kind of walk around and
you
just,
can walk by the tourists and say, I got a research pass. that's cool. Okay. Yeah.
So, I mean, and all you have to do, really, I don't know if this is like state secrets, but all you have to do is just sit through a little flip presentation where they walk you through the National Archive procedures on how to protect documents and just kind of figure out, you know, don't take anything, don't steal anything. You're not allowed to bring jackets or any kind of briefcase or backpack in so that you can't steal anything out.
Yeah, don't stuff them down your pants. Yeah. Somebody learned that once. Yeah.
So then I got my research pass, and then so on Monday, which was Memorial Day, the archive room was closed, so I went and toured the museum, and that was probably the busiest day at the library because it's obviously a day off, so different schools have field trips and all sorts of things. So I walked through, and that was probably one of the most humanizing moments for me in terms of Reagan's presidency, as in terms of his whole life, because they do a fantastic job of walking you through his early years, through his work, through acting, through all of the different radio programs that he hosted and all of the things that he learned from that, and kind of the political bent that he started to take while doing a lot of those radio shows. And then they walk you through his presidency, starting with domestic issues, starting with the beginning of his presidency. You know, they talk about the recession that he came into and how a lot of his policies got the nation out of that kind of period of crisis. this. And then they walk you through. Now that he's handled domestic issues, they take you into foreign issues. And they say, okay, now this is his whole fight against communism. And this was the whole stance that he took here. And, of course, they have the entirety of Air Force One was reassembled in the Reagan Library. And that was something that he really wanted to happen for the people. He wanted it to be accessible. He wanted politics to be accessible for the democracy, for people to be able to see it. And so this was the plan that I think Nixon had through Bush too. So I think Obama was the first, got a brand new plane, which was deserved, because walking through the old one, there was some old technology on there.
Yeah, like, you know, planes go through a lot of abuse, and I can imagine Air Force One being used a lot. You want to change that thing up every so often. Yeah.
So that was really cool to kind of just sit there and think about all of the people who had slept on this plane, who had been on this plane and done, you know, negotiations and all of these different things aboard this aircraft. And so that I'm sure was exactly what Reagan wanted from it. Then it walks you through his assassination attempt, and has a whole piece on communism and how he fought that, and some of the more foreign affairs-y kind of stuff. His strategy was peace through strength. And so that was a whole section of the library. And so, I mean, it was as much as the letters were tangible, that really created a Reagan that I could look at, and a concept in my mind that I could – and I was taking extensive notes through the whole thing to get quotes that were central and kind of some indicative quotes of the central core of who Reagan was as a person and as a president as well. And so I was able to draw a lot of conclusions about him, his character from that day.
And so what did you do in the archives then?
So that was the next 2 days. After that Monday walking through the library, walking through the museum, then I spent the next 2 days in the archive. So that was a pretty simple process. You just took a withdrawal slip and you filled out all of the different boxes that you wanted. And there was a little catalog online that you could look through to kind of figure out. And it was organized by topic and such. So I just looked at some of the things that I wanted to find. And then an archivist would come and take your slip and go and get all of the boxes. And the boxes were filled with folders. And then you had to search through the folders to figure out what had good information for you. So I would pull out one folder at a time, as was mandated by the National Archive, and flip through. And when I found something that would be useful, I scanned it in, read it, kind of made sure that it was a part. I knew I was on a time crunch, so there was a limit to how detailed I could read in the first pass. So I knew that I had to scan some of it, and if it was really good, or if it was from a folder or a person that was especially detailed or especially relevant to what I was studying, then I would spend a little bit more time with it and hunker down and kind of read through it and look for policies, look for actions that Reagan was taking that were indicative of a Christian faith or that were indicative of strong beliefs that I could then note and come back to later.
Okay, so I was going to ask you that. What were you specifically looking for? But you were looking for things that were indicative of his religious faith.
Yes.
And how that informed his policies and governing style.
Yes.
Okay.
If I had more time, I probably could have spent longer looking for specific Reagan quotes that had to do with a particular policy and then looking at that policy. But for this period, there was a lot that I had to rely on firsthand from the time, but say chief of staff testimony or say different first assistance or different things. So there, I mean, it all was authoritative on Reagan. It was all firsthand accounts, but not all of the quotes that I ended up using or getting were directly from Reagan. And I felt fine about that because these were policies that he was signing into law. So I felt good about these actually being on his authority and his word. So.
And this, again, I want to emphasize quite a feat for a high school project. I mean, a lot of college students don't even get that in depth in this. And you were on a 3-week project. You had a couple days in the library, so you're finding out what you can. But you also, again, had this unique insight that you had letters that nobody else had ever seen that were sitting in your grandfather's garage. And that's very cool. And it, I before we get into your thesis here, the other thing that you did down at the Simi Valley Library that you mentioned was that you donated these letters to the archive.
Yeah, that was a really cool moment. I handed them in, and then the archivist who I handed them to mentioned that someone upstairs in the Reagan Foundation, on the Reagan Foundation floor, would like to see them. So I got to go and meet the chief administrative officer of the Reagan Foundation, and she offered to give me a personal tour of kind of the upstairs offices, which included Reagan and Ronald and Nancy's offices upstairs, and kind of a lounge space for different discussions and such, and a ballroom kind of place for dining. And so that was really cool. Reagan's desk had not been touched mostly since he had passed on. And in Nancy's office, the coolest thing that I thought from upstairs was there was the 21st cannon shell from the 21 cannon salute at Reagan's funeral. And so those were just a couple of really kind of more tangible things that I could look at and say, this was Reagan's. Reagan was here. And so that was kind of a close connection there. And she mentioned that if I ever wanted to come back down, that would be – or that I should contact them. And so, I mean, just kind of getting the impact that my grandfather meant something to the Reagans and that people who were close to the Reagans knew that. And that was probably one of the coolest moments of the trip, was just kind of being there and seeing that my family had an impact on the Reagans, and that they were close and all of that. So
you did all this research down in Simi Valley. You're looking through that. You're reading through the letters, and the next step of the process is putting this all together into some kind of thesis. So tell us what your thesis was. And you have a couple interesting findings here. The first question that you asked was Reagan's faith really authentic? And that's an important question, because we see a lot of politicians on the news today, and they fake a lot of stuff to make themselves look good in that. But so that, I thought that was a really good question. And how did you approach that question? What did you find?
I used a C.S. Lewis Mere Christianity definition of Christian, and so that requires not that you necessarily see change within a person, but it requires, that you are actively seeking God. And so from that perspective, a lot of Reagan's background and a lot of his emphasis on prayer really affirmed that he was a devout Christian from that kind of a standpoint. And I do want to mention, before I left, the evening before I left, I interviewed my grandfather. And so those were some of the best insights that I got, kind of beyond the documents, beyond the speeches, beyond the rhetoric, who was Reagan as a Christian. And so I'll kind of come back to that. But one of the things that my grandfather mentioned was that he was great with the fundamentals, which my grandfather said were prayer, church, heaven, and the authority of the Word of God. And so in those regards, Reagan was great. Reagan had firm foundations, and so I found that he was actively trying to pursue God throughout the presidency. And so that had guided a lot of his policy decisions, that guided a lot of his core beliefs, that guided a lot of his actions. And so for me, that was a great kind of point to start.
In terms of what your grandpa said in terms of that, I guess this is a really interesting insight, because again, as we're talking about whether a politician has authentic faith or not, you see somebody going in the church, you say, well, if they're going to a church on Sunday, it's probably pretty good. But these were all private conversations and private letters that you had with your grandparent that were outside of the public view. And so that must have reaffirmed the authenticity of the faith, because Reagan is really struggling with some of these questions and consulting with his pastor in Bel Air all the way across the country on some of these issues.
Yeah. I was a little disappointed as to the content of those letters. I mean, we do have some things like the Sandinistas, but other than that, there was a lot that he kind of left my grandfather to do on his own. For example, during the governorship, he put my grandpa in charge of this, or at least on the council for creating a set of moral guidelines for education. And as my grandfather remembers, he was the only Presbyterian minister on that council, and so he saw his role as to really kind of add this religious component. But Reagan was largely out of that picture. He didn't have much control over what was going on that council. So a lot of the religious aspects that my grandfather took over and then mentioned to Reagan were largely my grandfather's own kind of projects. That, yes, he was handed from Reagan, and that Reagan said, you know, I'm setting you out to do this. And so my grandfather knew, as the Presbyterian minister, that his job was to bring the Presbyterian perspective to that issue. But there wasn't a lot of back and forth engagement on that. And I think in one regard that shows a lot of trust from Reagan, that he's saying, you're my minister, I trust you to bring this component as I would see fit. But then in another regard, he's leaving a lot of this religious a lot of the religious aspects of these policies outside of his kind of touch.
And that is another thing that comes out in your project, and I want to talk about that next. So Reagan was good with the fundamentals. By C.S. Lewis' definition, thumbs up there. How does it affect his style of governing? Did his faith actively present itself into policy decisions and the way he approached his governing style?
It only really did in terms of prayer and as a moral compass. Reagan gave a speech at an ecumenical prayer breakfast in 82. I think it was 1982, and I showed this at my project presentation. I showed a couple of clips, and he really emphasized over and over again that religion had a place in politics, and that religion was the source of morality for a nation. He mentioned, kind of from a pragmatic viewpoint, that by his analysis, by his interpretation, if you looked back at all of these great cultures, he said, that you would see when they began to fall, it was because they turned away from their religious ideals. And so for him, it wasn't this grand theological concept that he was dealing with. It was simply, it's the moral center for our nation. Our nation needs a moral center. We need guiding principles, and we need to get those from religion. From his father, he gathered a sense of tolerance. His father, for instance, one time refused to stay at a hotel that he was told he would enjoy because it was anti-Semitic. So there was a lot of tolerance that he gained from his father, and that was one of the main attributes that he gained from his father. And so at this ecumenical prayer breakfast, Reagan completely endorsed being a Jew, being different from different faiths, because he knew that they all brought this moral compass to a person, and what he said was that the personal life impacted your public life, and that the two were inseparable. And so when you have these religious beliefs in your personal life, that then they express themselves. And so that was pretty much as far as his religion was concerned in his politics. That's as far as they went. My grandfather said that he didn't see Reagan as a very theologically sound, or not sound, not a very theologically diverse or knowledgeable person. He didn't read theology, he said. He read politics. And so my grandfather kind of asked if he had learned a lot of what he knew about his religion from Republicans that he had watched growing up or listened to growing up. And I kind of pushed back a little bit on that, because from what I had seen, his mother had given him a strong Christian background. She raised him in the Disciples of Christ Church in Hollywood, California. But my grandmother went to that same church, and while I was interviewing my grandfather, my grandmother was also there. And she mentioned that the church was missing a lot of the personal faith component. That they talked a lot about following after Christ's example, but not a lot about relating with Christ, not a lot about being with Christ, having time with Christ. So Reagan got the prayer part. I mean, he's pursuing God's intentions, but not proactively. It's a very decision-by-decision piece. And so that's where we get into a lot of my kind of final conclusions.
Well, let me ask you about those final conclusions. One thing to back up a little bit, too, and in your report, you mentioned in terms of what your grandfather said and what he observed in terms of Reagan's relationship with his theology and what he was doing in the White House. Reagan had said that, you know, he has a job to do, right?
Oh, yeah.
This wasn't a... necessarily a manifest destiny thing. He was a person that says, I got elected to this position. There are certain things that you have to do, A, B, and C every day, and I got to roll up my sleeves and do those things. So it wasn't necessarily theologically driven all the time. And I think you put this very nicely, that, you know, this set his religion, his faith sets a moral compass, and then he still has to go to work, but all that stuff is in the background.
Yeah. So there was also in that first thesis that I created, I was asking, if Reagan is a Christian, which I found that he was, then how does that faith impact his politics? From my perspective, outside of the research, this was before I got into all of the research, and so I posited that he was a Christ above culture Christian, and this is from the Richard Niebuhr's book Christ in Culture. And it outlines five ways that Christians can interact with culture. And so the Christ above culture standpoint is an isolated standpoint. Its key cornerstone example is St. Thomas Aquinas, who's credited as the father of scholastics. So he's a monk. He's separated from culture. He's not engaging with culture on a day-to-day basis. But he's also trying to impact culture with different policies, in Reagan's case, or different educational examples, different educational models, in the case of Thomas Aquinas. So I asked, and at first I'll say, when we went over this in class, I had a problem with this viewpoint because I didn't think it gave sin enough credit, that it said, I can impact culture without culture impacting me. But then looking back at Reagan and asking if someone is actually isolated from culture, maybe then they can maintain that position because they're outside of it, so they're able to look at it from a different kind of perspective, from an up-high perspective, and still have the ability to change it as a president has. And so I said, okay, I think Reagan could be a Christ above Christian. Christian. Mm-hmm. Christ above culture,
Christ
Christian.
Above culture. Right.
Yeah. A Christ above culture, Christian. And so I was kind of gaining some kind of hope for this viewpoint, that saying, okay, maybe he was able to impact culture, and then he did. So then I posited this to my grandfather, and I'd like to read the quote that my grandfather gave back to me in this case. He said, I think you are giving Reagan far more credit than he deserves, and that I don't see him as being able to articulate the kinds of things you and I have just spoken about culture. Am I going to change culture? Am I going to identify with culture? Or am I going to be crushed by culture? As you mentioned earlier, he said he was going to do a job for the citizens of the state of California in a more political sense, and my feeling was that he couldn't or didn't want to talk theology very much, as Niebuhr would want to talk. I don't think he read extensively in theology. I think he read politics. I don't think he would feel that he could change culture. And so for me, looking from this Christ above culture standpoint, now I'm having to stand back and kind of ask, did he really fulfill this kind of standpoint? Did he set a revolutionary perspective on politics? And for me, I had to kind of answer no. And so this is where some of my conclusions started to come in, because I kind of the final question that my grandfather and I came to during that interview was, did his political life shape his religious life, or did his religious life shape his political life? And in that regard, we came to the conclusion that he entered into his political career with a strong religious and rhetorical background. But then as time passed, his beliefs began to be shaped by his office, and that he lost sight of a lot of the big picture that he came into the office with. And so he got caught up in some of the mire of individual decisions that were put in front of him, and he prayed over those, and he actively sought God in every decision, but that he deviated a little bit from his religious compass because he wasn't looking forward. He wasn't looking to where the compass was pointing. He was just saying, oh, the compass is pointing north. So he wasn't looking ahead. It was very much a prescriptive kind of a, or descriptive mm-hmm. kind of a faith in that regard.
And I can imagine that too. I mean, you're the president of the United States and you want to remain faithful to your own spiritual roots, but it's got to be tough.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's the stuff that you have to deal with. And this is not just a lesson for the president of the United States. So all presidents of the United States who are listening to this podcast, you can take that to heart. But also for us in our daily life, I would imagine, too. I mean, as a professor at a university, as going somebody working at a banking firm or something like that, you get mired in the details a lot. And it's very difficult sometimes to stick with your moral compass.
Yeah. I mean, and he did do an admirable job. I mean, because there are things that you just don't have an opinion on going into office. And that's a rough reality for many people to deal with. But as a political candidate, you're often only dealing with kind of the hot button issues. And then during your presidency, those change drastically. And you're faced with things that you never thought you would be. And so then to be faced with making all of these decisions that you never thought that you would have to make, you then have to kind of stand back and go, well, shoot, now I have to come up with a stance on this. Now I have to kind of figure out how I feel about this. And it's a very moment-by-moment decision. And so that's kind of hard to do if you don't have a sense of where you believe God is leading the nation. And so that's when I came to kind of some of my final conclusions was that really about the decision-by-decision prayer process.
Tell us about that.
So I mean, I admit it. It brought him a lasting name in the evangelicals' collective conscious. I mean, everybody still totes on Reagan. Everybody loves Reagan. And some people suggest that that's the constant post-presidential popularity that most presidents end up with. But it also brought him a permanent place in history books for bringing America out of a recession, but into a kind of temporary period of economic and social prosperity. So what I was kind of wondering then at the end was how much opportunity cost, or how much he could have even been more successful, been more permanently successful, had he left a more permanent legacy, if he had left the nation and had been more intentional about his political and religious integration. So really kind of looking, where am I going with this? What is this leading to? Where do I want the nation to be after this decision is over? He had these core principles, and he applied them well, and they worked well during his presidency, but they didn't last much longer than that. A lot of the kind of economic stuff came crumbling a little bit after he left office. So and I'm not saying that if he had simply looked more to God that he could have totally saved the nation, because we are fallen, and so there's a lot that we just can't account for in terms of economics, in terms of all of this. But there is a large portion of it that I think we can be more successful in our decision-making process if we have an idea of where we're going. And so for my project, I pulled out a verse, 1 Chronicles 22:19, which says, "Now devote your heart and soul to seeking the Lord your God. Begin to build the sanctuary of the Lord God so that you may bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord and the sacred articles belonging to God into the temple that will be built for the name of the Lord." For this brings a lot of proactive thinking about what kind of a sanctuary do I want to build for the Lord? What kind of a space do I want to create within the United States as a president for people to worship God, for people to come closer to their Creator, even from a, not a universalist, but from a kind of tolerant perspective? How can I bring people closer to their faiths in general? How can I make this nation a safe nation for any religion to be practiced? And that is what I think Reagan was missing.
Mm-hmm. Some very, very sophisticated analysis here for a high school project, and I'm very, very impressed with what you've done, and which is why we're having you on here. You can go toe-to-toe with some of the best scholars around now.
Thank you.
So my next question then is that you've just graduated from high school. You're only about 2 weeks out of high school, and not many people are looking down the road now. You're just enjoying summer. What next for Phoenix Mumo?
I am going to Northeastern University in the fall. I'm going to study computer science and business. And a lot of people don't know what they're doing, but both of those major tracks are things that you really have to get going on in your freshman year. So those have been interests of mine for a long time, and a lot of people have asked me, so has this project kind of made you want to go into politics or into theology? And I say, well, Not really. I have so enjoyed getting this kind of perspective on it, and I love theology. I've loved a lot of the kind of Christian studies classes that I've taken at Bear Creek and a lot of the different perspectives that I've gained. But there, at the end of the day, there's a lot that I have to come back to and say, there's a lot that's kind of messed up in politics. And I'm not sure if I can fix that from within the system. So, I mean, I will not stop thinking about a lot of the things that I've learned from this. And I will not stop thinking about theology or politics in my future. But yeah, computer science leads me to kind of the technology side that I'm also very passionate about.
Well, that sounds like a wonderful future, and I think you're going to be crafting yourself a wonderful future, and we look forward to seeing what you will do in that future. And Phoenix, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.